Welcome to the Hot House, the podcast that goes bump in the night.
To go on location somewhere.
We do need to go on location somewhere. Where do you want to go?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Everywhere.
Well, I feel like maybe what we should do is we should do a poll, because we can do that with the miracle that is social media, and we'll ask the people that listen to us on a regular basis where they want us to go. Okay. And we can give them some options. So yeah, so, how's everything going, Mimi?
Oh, everything's well. How are you doing?
Oh, you know, I'm doing all right. I'm trying to keep my sanity.
Yeah, me too.
I don't usually have much of my sanity to begin with, so I'm just trying to hold on to it.
Good.
All right, so we talked a little bit before we started recording about what we had this week. And each of us had a short one and a long one.
Yes.
So my long one is Haunting in Connecticut, Fact or Fiction. What do you have this week, Mimi?
I am doing a story on Hearthstone Historic House Museum in Appleton, Wisconsin.
That's actually a place I've never been.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what really intrigued me as I'm searching stuff was the pictures of the house, and mm-hmm. of the mansion, actually. It's stone and wood, and it moves. You know, I love houses that have actual movement to them, mm-hmm. and just are not straight boxes.
That's your artistic mind.
Yeah, I guess so. So, anywho, the Hearthstone Mansion was built in 1882 by Henry J. Rogers. This mansion was the first in the world, yes, I said it, in the world, to have hydroelectrical electricity in the whole house. And he used Thomas Edison's designs. And the actual fixtures and the wiring and all of that still in the house.
Cool.
Rogers owned a paper plant, which he also ran with hydroelectricity. It was right on the Fox River, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then his mansion was really close.
Right. So what year is this?
1882,
and they had hydroelectric. That's pretty cool. Yeah.
That is really cool. Hmm. Then from 1900 to 1930, well, I guess I should tell you that in 1889, I think, okay, well, in the late 1800s, Rogers and his family moved down to Chicago. And in 1900 till 1930, a man and his family by the name of A.W. Priest owned the house. And they were really happy in the house. They just loved it there.
Hmm.
And unfortunately, in 1930, he died. A.J. Priest was a philanthropist and an entrepreneur. After he died in 1930, John Carter Badenoch bought the mansion and turned it into Hearthstone Tea Room. That was in 1931. Then he sold it to Frank Harriman. Actually, he rented it out to Frank Harriman from 1933 to 1938. And in 1940, Frederick H. Hoffman bought the mansion. And he had it until 1960 when the Maris family lived there. And they had it until 1986. Then in 1986, the Friends of Hearthstone bought the building, remodeled it, brought it back to its original mm-hmm. state, and are using it as a museum now. They're still actually doing some reconstruction on it. People have been known to feel like they're being watched in there. The people that work there, the employees, feel like somebody's watching them, sometimes not so nicely. Like they're being intently watched and they get a creepy feeling.
Hmm.
But they think it's the ghost of A.J. Priest or A.W. Priest.
Now, I know in a lot of the ghost hunting shows that I watch, they talk about the meters that they use to tell them how much energy is in a room. Mm-hmm. And they say that if you have a feeling of intense paranoia or a feeling of intensely being watched, that it could just potentially be like wiring.
Oh, and with the
hydroelectric to excess stuff, yeah, right? So I wonder.
Okay.
Hmm.
Well, we know he was very happy there, and they feel that he didn't want to leave the place, and he's watching to make sure that, you know, everybody does the right thing in his mansion.
Right. Sure.
So the mansion itself is 4 stories tall. It has gray stone and brick on the outside, and it has wooden trim with a really steep roof and a massive multiple brick fireplaces. It also has a wraparound porch, which I really love on those old houses. I always wanted a house with a wraparound porch.
Yeah, you know, when we were looking for houses, we came upon a Victorian that was just beautiful. It needed a new roof,
mm-hmm.
But they only wanted like $60,000 for it.
Uh-huh.
And it had one of those huge front porches. You know, it didn't wrap all the way around, but it went along the entire front half of the house.
Right.
I really wish we had bought that house. That was such a great house. Oh. It was in Walker's Point, too.
Okay, well, maybe you still will someday.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. But yeah, totally with you on the wraparound porch.
Yeah. Now, employees of the museum have heard noises, especially sneezing. They hear a lot of sneezing when nobody sneezed at all.
Oh.
Which is really weird. Sneezing. I mean, who comes up with sneezing? I mean, you hear moaning, or you hear groaning, or you hear
banging, knocking, scratching, scraping. But
sneezing? Okay, sneezing. So that's kind of strange.
You have a ghost with allergies. That's nice.
Yep. Volunteers feel like, I said before, that they're being watched.
Right.
And the manager, when she comes in every single morning, she says, "Hello and good morning, Mr. Priest." I think that's so cute.
That is cute.
Visitors have had experiences of feeling watched. And one visitor saw curtains moving when there was no breeze and the window was closed.
Hmm.
So this is on my list of places that I'd like to go visit. Just because I think the architecture is probably beautiful. And I'd love to see the original workings of hydroelectricity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Never seen that. But it looks like a really beautiful place to visit. Who knows? Maybe I'll have my own experience there.
Maybe.
So that was the end of my story for today.
Well, what I have for you today, like I said, it is the haunting in Connecticut. I am sure that at this point in time, you probably know all about it. There are very few people out there who don't know what exactly happened in the house. There have been discussions with, you know, people who have lived on the street as the same, you know, as this family, and have said that they saw, you know, absolutely nothing, and they have nothing to contribute, you know, other than they were kind of a weird family. The one lady, I watched a documentary on it on YouTube, and the one lady said something like, you know, they were an odd family. There was like people coming and going at all hours of the night. And on summer nights when it was really warm, they would have all the windows open, and the kids who lived there would be like running around the outside of the house going, ooh, in the windows. So
Well, they didn't show that in the movie.
Yeah, she just, and the movie actually varies greatly from what actually quote unquote happened.
Oh, wow.
If anything actually happened at all.
Okay.
Because there's been a lot of paranormal experts who have come forward and said, you know, there was nothing there. Like, you know, we investigated it, or, you know, we did this or that and the other thing, and there was just nothing there. So,
who owns the house now, do you know?
I am not entirely sure who owns it right at this point in time. I do know that it has been completely remodeled. So it's, you know, it's been done up again. The people who lived there, the Snedeker family, you know, they were renting it, and it wasn't really, you know, kept up all that well. It was kind of, you know, scruffy and whatever, and needed some help. So I guess the new people moved in there and they've done it up or whatever, and they don't say that they've experienced anything. Now, a lot of people would argue, if they know the story about this particular house, well, you know, it was exorcised. Mm-hmm. You know, they went in and they exorcised the space, and so now there are no ghosts there, which is why they're not experiencing anything. But there are certain parts of this story that kind of make you wonder. Things that make you go, hmm.
Do you happen to know if the people who owned the house and renting it to the people in the story of the haunting in Connecticut, if they had ever experienced anything? Is that why they were renting it out?
I think that they were just renting it out because they had it, you know, in their family or whatever. And they had the space and they wanted to make some money off it, so they rented it out. But it sounded like the landlord that rented it to the Snedeker family didn't know anything about anything that was going on in the house. Now, he did know that it was previously a funeral home. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was something that was well known throughout the entire community. In this documentary that I watched, there were two or three different people that they interviewed that said, yeah, you know, I helped the former owners with, you know, retrieval at the hospital.
Yeah.
You know, he needed my help to get a body from the hospital morgue and bring it back to the funeral home. There were two more ladies that said, you know, they had worked in the home as the people that do the cosmetic work on the bodies. So they would come in and they would do makeup and they would do hair, and they never experienced anything. All right. They just went in there and they did their work and they went home, and they just never had any experiences at all. So I don't know. Kind of makes you wonder. So
yeah, it makes me wonder.
So here's what I have for you. It's a familiar tale. A struggling family moves into a beautiful house ready to make it a home. They fill their new home with artifacts, mementos from family vacations, photographs, and textiles. Then a darkness seems to settle over the space. There are strange noises in the night. Family members begin acting strangely. You can feel eyes moving over you. There are shadows moving in your periphery. This house is far from being a home. In 1986, the Snedeker family rented a beautiful colonial-style home in Southington, Connecticut. Carmen Snedeker found it was large enough for her entire family and was reasonably priced, and that basically encouraged an immediate move. Carmen had been driving her son some distance from their current home for cancer treatments, and the drive was difficult on him due in part to the nausea and, you know, whatnot from the treatments. After searching for some time for a home closer to the hospital, the colonial home seemed to almost drop conveniently into their lap. The landlord said that they were welcome to move in immediately. She had struggled with finding a place that would allow four children, and so she and her family did so without even really thinking about it. That was another thing that I found really interesting. There are places that won't rent to somebody who has four kids. I feel like that's not a thing.
I don't know. I've heard of people who don't want to rent
to
people that have kids. Yeah.
Yeah, because I thought it was something like, you know, discriminatory.
Well,
like you're not allowed to.
I think it has to be posted that we don't rent to.
Yeah, so.
I don't know. I didn't think that there were that many places like that around, though.
Yeah, you wouldn't think so. I mean, it seems like landlords nowadays are more, you know, apt to rent out their property as opposed to put up all these weird restrictions.
Well, there must have been different laws back in 19...
Oh, that could be, too. That could be. Those crazy 80s.
Yeah, they were.
So, in this scenario, even though they had this new house to move into, Carmen's husband, Alan, still had to travel for work. But on weekends, he was there as often as he possibly could be. As the family started moving their belongings in, they began to notice that there was something odd about the house itself. Above each doorway on the main floor, there was a crucifix that was mounted, and they appeared to be old, as if they had been there for some time. So they're like those plastic jobbies, you know, that collect like the grease from your kitchen and, you know, smoke and whatever. So they were yellow and old. In the basement, when they went to investigate the basement, there were strange tables lined against the wall containing what appeared to be medical tools. And in the center of one of the rooms was this long metal table that was on a swivel. In the corner of the basement was a large drain, and a large hoisting mechanism was situated on one of the main walls. The family soon realized that the home that they had moved into was originally the Hallahan Funeral Home and had operated as such since sometime in the 1930s. Some of the neighbors actually in that documentary that I watched speculated that it had actually run a lot longer than that. This in itself didn't make it impossible to live in the house. After all, a funeral home is nothing to fear. Yes, corpses had once been stored in the basement. And yes, there had been coffins, you know, lifted into the viewing area on the first floor. Mm-hmm. Yes, there had been dead prepared, embalming, draining of fluids had taken place. Every old house has a history. But after a very short time, the history of this particular house began to show its face. Carmen's son, Philip, began exhibiting strange behavior in the movie they call him Matt. He was irritable, paranoid, and prone to fits of anger. Carmen chalked the behavior up to the medication and treatments that he was receiving for his cancer, believing that some of the things that Philip claimed to see were only in his mind. He would tell Carmen that he saw men in the basement with long, dark coats, and he said that he spoke with the ghost of a young boy with black hair down to his hips who had lost his life in the house. When one of Philip's episodes became violent, threatening the safety of his siblings, Carmen made the difficult decision to have her son institutionalized. She basically believed that it would be safer for everybody involved if he just wasn't in the house any longer. When Philip actually left, the activity in the house escalated. One by one, the crucifixes above the doorways on the first floor inexplicably disappeared. And then it seemed as if when the crucifixes were removed, the paranormal activity that was once confined to the basement only started to move upstairs to the rest of the house. A couple of things that happened, they placed food in the refrigerator. They would look at it, they would eat something, and then they would come back a very short time later and it would all be rotten. Mm-hmm. Carmen, while cleaning the kitchen floor, found that the mop water turned blood red on contact and began to smell of decay. I believe this is all featured in the movie.
Yes.
No matter how much she tried to mop it away, the puddle just kept getting bigger. Mm-hmm. The children began seeing shadows moving in their rooms at night, heard strange noises and voices, experienced objects being thrown by unseen hands. The Snedeker children claimed that even leaving the house gave no relief. The spirits harassing them at home would follow them into social situations. So if they went out to a movie, either they or their friends would experience the sensation of being touched, or on a couple of occasions actually slapped.
Oh, wow.
Both parents reported that they had been raped and sodomized by demons. Many people asked why the family just didn't move, and Kerman stated that not only would they lose their deposit for breaking their lease, something that they were financially unable to do, they worried that the dark energy in the house would simply attach to them and then it would go with them wherever they went. After a few weeks, the activity in the house had gotten so bad that the family had to sleep together in the living room on air mattresses because they were simply too afraid to sleep in any of the bedrooms.
Now, in the movie, they showed that the boys moved into the basement, did they?
One of the boys, Matt, the boy with cancer, who is Philip, Carmen's son, they depict him only as moving into the basement.
Okay, yeah.
So he sets his room up down there. He says it's colder down there, you know, it's like there's a private bathroom. So he said that he would be more comfortable down there.
So he did actually move
into the basement. And there were a couple of things in the movie that actually happened. Like he did actually move into the basement. They did actually play hide and seek at one point, and Philip asked his younger brother to get up on the table on the swivel, and he's spinning him around, and then the boy starts to see flashes of things. Around him. So apparently that happened too.
Okay.
That's also, you know, in the account of the Snedeker family, as well as in the movie. So it's at this point, when the family is all horrified and living together in one room in this house, that Carmen decides that she's going to call Ed and Lorraine Warren. Ed and Lorraine Warren are self-proclaimed demonologists. They know a lot about the occult. You know, a lot of people call them when there are severe hauntings like this to try to come to some remediation, either through exorcism or you know, I don't know, cleansing or something. Once the Warrens arrived, it didn't take long for them to declare that the house was haunted and recommend that the family go public about their experience, because, as Lorraine Warren stated, it would be easier to get the Catholic Church to take notice and get them involved if there was some sort of public outcry. Kerman's husband was reluctant to go public at first, but after living in the home for so long, he had reached his breaking point. Their story was made public, and the home was, eventually at least, as the Warrens claimed, successfully exorcised. Then the story kind of takes a little bit of a turn and kind of casts doubt on everything that has happened in this home. Horror novelist Ray Garten brought the Snedeker story to light at the Warrens' insistence. Garten interviewed each family member individually about their experiences, but he encountered a problem. None of the stories matched up, and they were unable to keep their story straight about the paranormal activity. Garten claims that he approached Ed Warren about the issue and was told that the whole family was essentially crazy. According to Garten, Ed told him to find what story he could and make the rest up. Quote, make it up and make it scary. According to some, that's exactly what Garten did. The current owners of the home state that they have had...
I just have to say one thing. I really like the Warrens. I find it really difficult to believe that Ed Warren would say that.
I find it a little hard to believe, too. And, of course, you know, Ed Warren is no longer with us. So it's hard for him to, you know, come out and say,
right,
you know, this is a lie. I don't know, maybe if somebody has a Ouija board, they can ask him.
Well, they say you're not supposed to do Ouijas.
Oh, no?
Because it brings the demonic spirits to you.
Oh, oh, I used to do them all the time when I was a teenager.
Did you? I did too.
On a regular basis. Yeah, on a regular basis. Yeah, the current owners of the home say that they have had no paranormal activity whatsoever, but they are constantly bothered by people trying to take pictures of the house, asking about their experiences while they lived there. Neighbors of the Snedekers have reported suspicious activities surrounding newspaper reports versus actual occurrences on the property, and they doubt that the property was ever actually haunted at all. Because it seemed like, one lady mentioned, every time something, there would be like a lot of people at the house, and then the next day, all of a sudden, there was something in the newspaper. Like clockwork, that would happen.
Huh.
So, she was speculative. You know, the question is the Haunting in Connecticut story just another Amityville horror story, or is there actually more to it? You know, were the Snedekers actually telling the truth about what they experienced? Neighbors and friends of the Snedeker children claim to have never heard anything, not one thing, about the haunting. Though they did see the Snedeker children running around outside on warm evenings and making spooky sounds through open windows. None of the children ever mentioned it. Not one. One friend reported that he was 8 at the time of the supposed haunting, and it was never brought up. So the question to that would be, were the children so afraid of what was happening in the house that they couldn't even bring themselves to speak of it? And then the other question would be, how realistic is it for a child around 8 years old to keep that kind of information secret?
Right.
You know, I mean, I would be talking up and down about that. Like, everybody would know about it.
Right.
But apparently none of the children in their grade knew anything about it. Their parents would know about it, but they read newspapers and they watched the news. And, you know, so they were aware of it. But the children apparently never said a word to anyone. So it makes you wonder if Carmen was feeding stories to her children for the press and then telling them to keep the information from their friends, because that doesn't pay. You know? We're not going to get paid for that.
Well, I might be jumping ahead, but didn't the son, Philip, didn't he go into remission?
Yes. In the film, he did, yes.
Did he?
And I believe in real life, yes, he did too.
Do you think maybe Mom had Munchausen?
I don't know.
Could that be a possibility?
I mean, you know, anything is possible, honestly.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so enter the 2009 film A Haunting in Connecticut, supposedly a true story about the Snedeker's ordeal. The movie claimed to be based on true events, and told of all the horrifying and demonic experiences that the family had had in the house. Now, overall, it wasn't a terrible movie, but it really seemed as if the movie deviated from Carmen's account. There was a lot of extra stuff in there. Mm-hmm. And I have here, I'm still trying to figure out where the box of eyelids, bodies hidden in the walls, huge fire engulfing the house, and carved symbols into Philip's body come into play. Because none of that happened. If by true events they mean a family moved into a supposedly haunted house and had some crazy shit happen to them, I suppose they're not wrong.
Right.
So this movie grosses over $77 million at the box office, and DVD sales top $1.5 million.
Wow.
But the truth is, there is little to no proof of paranormal activity in the case of the Snedeker family. Perhaps they saw all the press that the Amityville Horror had received, and they found out how the Lutz family had profited from their story. Mm-hmm. Maybe mounting medical bills from Philip's treatment made the opportunity to craft a believable story impossible to resist. I mean, you know, desperate times.
Right.
You know, people do desperate things. Well, so
now I have a lot more questions than I used to have.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, what? So you think it could be Munchausen?
Maybe. To get all the attention, you know, and putting him in a mental hospital.
Yeah.
I think that was pretty dramatic.
Well, apparently he was attacking his siblings.
Well.
I mean, whether or not.
But the siblings never talked about it? They didn't have bruises on them?
They
go to school with bruises?
Yeah, see, I don't know. I don't know.
Just a lot of unanswered questions that I never thought of before. Yeah.
But there, like I said, I mean, there are a lot of things in the movie that just mm-hmm. don't translate to the, you know, the quote-unquote right. true events. You know, she never mentions finding, I think you remember in one of the opening scenes in the movie, she finds the pictures, mm-hmm. the post-mortem photographs.
Right.
And there's no mention of that.
Right.
It's basically like, we bought this house because we needed a place to stay. We moved in. We found out it was a funeral home fairly shortly thereafter. We started to experience some weird shit. We called demonologists. They exorcised the place. The end. And then when you watch the movie, it's like, well, we, you know, there were birds flying around in the rooms late at night and, like, random shadow figures, you know, behind them in the hall and the one thing that Carmen Snedeker did mention that was portrayed in the movie was the babysitter or like the caregiver, some cousin or something. I forget what her role in it was, but she's taking a shower. And
it was a cousin who was watching the kids.
Yeah, and the reverend calls and says, you know, I removed the bones from, you know, this one guy, this Jonah, I think his name was. And so, you know, I removed his bones, but now he's not in the house anymore. And he was keeping all the other evil spirits at bay. So you guys need to get out. You need to get out.
Yeah.
And then she gets attacked by the shower curtain. So apparently that actually happened. So that was like, you know, there was a duality there. But yeah, like box of eyelids and like having all these weird like things curved into.
TV producers kind of.
They embellished a little bit.
Sounds like they embellished a lot.
They added a little bit to it. Yeah, it was really not the glorified story that, you know.
Okay.
I think it was it Lionsgate? I think that was the film company that put it out.
I can't tell you.
But, yeah, there was definitely some embellishment there.
Huh.
But,
okay.
No, I'd be interested to do a little bit more research and, like, Read read some of the newspaper reports because they were in the newspaper apparently quite a lot. So
leaked it all to the newspaper? That would be interesting.
Well, right. I mean, I know that when Ed and Lorraine told them to go public, I mean they called the newspaper people and were like, "Hey, this is what's going on in our house." And I didn't read.
Ed and Lorraine tell them to go public because I didn't think Lorraine
Warren said in an interview that she wanted them to go public because it is easier for the Catholic Church to get involved if you go public.
Oh.
And she believed that they needed the services of an exorcist to get all of this demonic energy out of the house. A lot of people have speculated that the reason why she did that was so that all of this attention could be focused on her and her husband doing all this work to try to get rid of all these spirits and exorcise the house. So, I mean, it makes you wonder, like, was it for financial reasons or was it to genuinely help someone?
I'm very resistant to the idea that the Warrens would be like that.
Yeah.
Very.
Yeah. But it, I mean, it makes you wonder, like.
Right, it does, but I don't want to. And so I'm did. Put that away.
So, okay, so here's another scenario. So the Warrens say, well, let's wait and let's go public when we feel that it's right to go public. And she pushes and says, no, we're going to go public right now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, two sides to every story.
Right.
And right now, we are not getting two sides. We're getting a movie and then some, you know, self-proclaimed demonologists saying that this is what, you know, this person said or this is what happened. So, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you, Mimi.
I wonder if the Warrens removed anything from the home.
The Warrens did not. This other guy who was working with them, I forget his name. I guess when they were doing the exorcism, they brought different artifacts, different religious artifacts. And there was a small statue of the Virgin Mary with, like, her arms outstretched and her palms open. And I guess after the exorcism, Carmen found the figure. And when she found it, it was missing the hands. The hands had gone. This guy, whoever he was, he took that figure and brought it to, I guess he has some sort of an occult museum.
Okay.
So he put it under a little dome in the occult museum, and like people can come and see it and whatever. So at the end of the interview, it shows her going in and like seeing it, you know, and saying, oh yeah, I remember, you know, no hands on the figure after
the exorcism. Now the guy who took the figure,
mm-hmm.
is he the same guy that has his own show now, where he's an older gentleman and he's got his daughter working with him, and they go into buildings and they look for, he has his own like museum in his house where he keeps things.
I don't know. I don't think so.
I can't think of his
but
name.
I'm not sure, and I don't remember his name either. I just remember he was on there he was on there briefly, and I was like, okay, you know, you have all this occult shit in your house, good for you. But he wasn't really, like, a huge part of the story. Like, he was with some ghost hunting team.
Yeah.
And so he talks about how he, you know, is sitting there, like, writing notes.
Mm-hmm.
And then something would happen. You know, and everybody would be in the same room because everybody was petrified. And then he'd be writing his notes and something would come flying off the wall.
Okay.
And actually, another really funny thing that makes you wonder if it was staged. When they're doing the interviews with Carmen, she's sitting with her back to this kind of, like, facade. I don't know if it's on some sort of soundstage or something, mm-hmm. but she's sitting there and she's talking to the guy and they're filming her front on, and the guy is asking her some questions, and all of a sudden there's, like, a big bang off to her right and, like, kind of a crash, so it sounds like something broke. And the producer says, you know, what was that just fell off the wall? Was that the crucifix that fell off the wall? And Carmen's like, yeah, you know, it was the crew. And she kind of laughs about it. And then the producer says, well, I don't really want to be here anymore. Like, I think we should leave. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they continue filming. So I don't know.
Okay.
But yeah, apparently the crucifix just flew off the wall and shattered. And they didn't show the crucifix after it had shattered. Like, no pieces, like, they didn't pick up pieces, and we're like, oh, yeah, you know, look at shattered.
See, that would have been a good time for them to do that.
Yeah.
If that indeed is what happened.
But is that demonic entities knocking a crucifix off the wall, or is that somebody didn't nail the nail in properly, and then the crucifix, you know, so.
Right.
But it makes you wonder how much of it is true then, and how much of it is sensationalized.
Right.
Because if you're just doing an interview. And at this point, the house is supposed to have been successfully exorcised.
Right.
So, how, like, is she even in the house? I don't even think she was in the house. They were probably just on a soundstage somewhere. And they set it up to look like that part of the house. And then all of a sudden this thing is fine. I don't know.
I don't know either.
It's just strange.
Oh. That was a good one.
Yeah, that was a good one. I'm always interested to go back and look at things that we've looked at before, but kind of find additional information to make them a little bit more interesting.
Right.
Because the story in itself is very interesting and very engaging. Either, you know, if you're of the camp that it's engaging because it's a true story, or if you're in the camp of it's engaging because it's a sensationalized story, or if you fall in some sort of gray area in the middle where you're like, I don't know if this is true or false, but it's kind of interesting. So yeah, I like to kind of pull that stuff out, give additional information about it. But yeah.
Sounds good.
That's The Haunting in Connecticut.
Okay. Now, yeah. I always liked that story. Now I have questions about it.
But that's okay. Questions are okay.
Right.
It's important to have questions.
Right.
You know, I mean, we always want to question the world around us and, you know, so that's good. Ask more questions. All right. So... let's see. Is that it for this week? Do we have anything other than the fact that we're going to do a poll?
Yeah, I think that's about it.
Yeah. So what we'll do is we'll try to work this week or next week. Well, when you guys listen to it, it'll be next week. Yeah. So next week we'll work on trying to find some places that might be cool to go in Wisconsin that are relatively close. And then, you know, we'll try to go there and, you know, based on popular demand.
Yeah.
And we'll maybe figure some stuff out. Maybe find some ghosts. You never know.
Maybe we can find a couple day trip things to do. Or even just go to Grant Park in the evening.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. So. That might be cool, too. All right. Well, I think that is it for us this week, guys.
Yep. Have a good one. Be safe.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. You stay spooky.
Oh, I like that one.
You like that one?
I do. That's a good one.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to this week's episode. For more Hauntheads, check out our blog at WordPress. You can find it at hauntheads.wordpress.com. We'd also like to thank you for your iTunes reviews, because your reviews will help us improve, and we value them greatly. You can find our podcast on Stitcher, Podcast Addict, Podbean, Pocket Casts, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Play, Podknife, and Blueberry. And don't forget to send us your paranormal stories or favorite folklore tales. You send them our way, we'll read them on the show. It's awesome. So you can send those to hauntheadscast@gmail.com. Keep listening and stay spooky.